Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. And this is Bookworm. And today I have the honor of having as my guest a writer who I think of as being one of the very best writers living in America. That's Charles Baxter. And we're talking about his new book, his sixth novel. I think there are five books of short stories plus a collected book of short stories. This new novel is called The Sun Collective, and it's published by Pantheon. And it's really a remarkable novel. Could you help me, Charlie? What kind of novel do you think it is?
I went back and forth while I was writing it on the question of whether I was putting together a realistic novel or one that was a kind of hybrid between realism and the fantastical. And I finally came to feel that the world of the novel that I was constructing was a kind of wonderland, which is not to say that it is a benevolent, heavenly place. Much of what does happen comes both out of the real world and out of another world, a kind of imaginary one.
I've read the book 2.5 times, and that's because, on the one hand, it is a family novel. And it's about a family that by the end has come back together and has enlarged. There's been a marriage, and yet we've watched this family on the verge of falling apart again and again. And on that verge, they are approached by different semi-magical people. One of them, a doctor, who's, am I remembering correctly? His last name is Jefferson?
Yes.
A doctor advises one of them that he should carry a mirror, a hand mirror, a face mirror, and let it rest in flowing water. And as he looks in it, to wash his face in the mirror. And this, he says, is an ancient magical healing tradition among his people. He is sort of a southerner. And I would like to say it's the kind of invention that's typical of Charles Baxter. It's toward the very beginning of the novel. Is this how you began to imagine it?
Yes. The novel, in effect, began with that episode. I had, years ago, been reading up on folklore cures that had been employed during the 1918 flu epidemic. This was long before any of us knew anything about COVID-19. But I discovered that a country cure or a form of prevention that people had talked about in the South and in the Midwest was exactly that. You would take a mirror to a river or to a creek, and you would wash your reflected face in the water, and you would be safe from all harm. Just as a digression, I had a meal with Louise Erdrich, and I told her about this discovery of mine, and she said, well, if you don't use that, I'm going to.
Well, yes, Louise would love it. It's her kind of thing, exactly. The character who is more or less the hero of the novel. His name is Harry Bredigan.
Yes.
He is on a train. The book takes place in Minneapolis, where many of your books and stories take place. He is facing what seems to be a lot of agitation. He's on the way to the Utopia Mall. Am I right in believing that it's the largest mall in America?
It is indeed. And the Utopia Mall is, of course, the Mall of America, as it's called here. But I wanted to change its name to give it a bit more of a metaphorical lift. So in my novel, it's called the Utopia Mall.
In the course of the novel, several people complain about metaphors. They feel that metaphors are destructive to them. And it's interesting because the book is about a group of people discovered by Harry's son, Tim, his wife, Alma, and eventually by Harry. They call themselves the Sun Collective, and their sign is a finger pointing more or less at the sun. And in a way, these people are in the process of escaping the metaphors that have been promoted about them. Those metaphors involve goodness, kindness, generosity, and one of the members, a man named Ludlow, has had it with goodness, kindness, generosity. He's interested in murder. He's interested in the end of the community values that the Sun Collective is about. And I would say that one of the things that makes the Sun Collective, by my guest Charles Baxter, so interesting is that things frequently point two ways at once. Did you design that?
I did. And I suppose the best way to describe this is to say that if you have an organization like the Sun Collective in a novel or in a story or in any kind of history, and there is only positive light emanating from it, you don't really have a story. There has to be a kind of negative force field built up around it. Something like the equivalent of what we used to call villainy. And when I began to get closer to the Sun Collective, I thought, oh, well, they have to have a manifesto. So I wrote a manifesto for them. It was about as serious as I could make it, but it's also a kind of send-up of the Communist Manifesto. I felt it was important for the coloration of the novel to get darker and darker with more and more shadows as it went on, even though formally the novel is kind of a comedy because it ends with a marriage and and with most of the innocent people in the book are not too badly hurt.
Well, you know, my theme song says, where would we be without books? And during this period, the Sun Collective seemed to me to be a book that I couldn't be without. It was, to my great impressed response, talking about our times. As you say, it's accidental that you learned about cures that surrounded the flu epidemic. But this book, The Sun Collective, has a nightmarish president who could only make me think about Trump. What's your president's name, Thorkelson?
Amos Alonzo Thorkelson. And the Amos Alonzo is from a few people have remarked on this to me. There was a well-known football and basketball coach of the 20th century named Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was a football coach at, of all places, the University of Chicago, when they still had a football team. And I had read somewhere, and I no longer remember who made this remark, that if fascism ever comes to the United States, it is likely that the president will want to be called coach. So I made his name this amalgamation of Amos Alonzo Stagg and Jacob Thorkelson, who was a senator from the state of Montana and was in his time a famous anti-Semite and who was accused of fascism.
I'm talking to Charles Baxter about his wonderful new novel, The Sun Collective. I wanted to ask you about why. Who is why?
Why is the spokesperson for The Sun Collective? And to some degree, is the charismatic leader, although as an anarchist collective, it can't very well have a charismatic leader. But he stands in for the rest of the group. But really what he is a kind of shapeshifter and confidence man. He's very difficult to see. All of the passages that I wrote in which he appears are written in such a way that you can't quite see him. His eyes, he claims, are very sensitive to light. So he's almost always in semi-darkness.
My thought was that this was a family novel about saving a family. They're a middle-class family. They've grown over the many, many years of the husband and wife's marriage, Alma and Harry, to be, perpetual nitpickers. There, you wouldn't want to sit in on a dinner with them if you could possibly avoid it. And yet, it is their form of love. And this includes a daughter who's moved away. She's a veterinarian. A son, Tim, who's been an actor, an actress who fell in love with him when he was in Uncle Vanya, killed herself, and he realized that this suicide was the product of his own behavior, and he stopped being an actor and begins living on the streets, eventually in Minneapolis, to try and find himself. Both his mother and his father are on a search for him. Beautifully, there are aspects of a wonderland in the book. They have a dog named Woland and a cat named Behemoth. Behemoth is the name of the devil's cat in The Master and Margarita. And the devil himself goes by the name of Woland. There's a rain of $5 bills that is also sort of a magic trick that comes from the master and Margarita. And the wife, Alma, begins talking to her dog and cat. They're very patient with her.
You know, the country cure that the doctor passes on to Harry Bredigan is one that he tries on Alma. And when this happens, she has a kind of cognitive event. It's a little bit like a mini stroke. And after it, she finds herself in conversations with the dog and the cat. And of course, you're exactly right. I mean, my lifelong love of Bulgakov and The Master and Margarita, a love that I know that you share, is very much a part of that. I really thought, though, that her conversations with her pets was a signal of her loneliness as she gets through late middle age.
It's heartbreaking because, you know, she has found members of the Sun Collective who would be her companions, but her cat and her dog know her better.
That's
and
right.
It's a really sensitive intellection that the dog and cat bring to her. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Charlie Baxter about his new novel, The Sun Collective. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Charlie Baxter about his new novel, The Sun Collective, in which a quest for a missing actor, Sun, brings about his mother's discovery of an enigmatic leader. Now, I found myself wanting The Sun Collective to be able to save people, and there are people who they do save. They give homeless people clothing, meals. They're what the fantasy of a new America needs. Even though they have their dark side, most of them, in fact, have eye problems, not just why, but Jefferson arrives and he seems to have, his glasses seem to be covering up something other than eyes. What is going on with the ability to see in this novel?
Well, I hope it doesn't seem too simple to say, but the characters are desperately in need of a vision that will help them live their lives. And the vision that the Sun Collective has is one of generosity, love, anti-consumerism. They are Luddites in the sense that they advise people to get off their computers and away from their screens. And so the idea of vision being not a luxury, but a kind of necessity runs through the whole book. And it's signaled by these characters who seem to be eerie in some way, to have come from a kind of uncanny universe, which is figured by the fact that they have peculiar eyeglasses.
Yes, there's a certain kind, you've just given me the cue, there's a certain kind of eerie realism that runs through your work. And it's more in this book than any other that the realism offsets the eeriness. Somehow or other, the world we're living in, its darkness, its unpleasantness, the character's desire for rescue somehow seems to take over from the eeriness and provide a realism that we all know, that we're all, in a sense, suffering from, huh?
Well, yes. I almost said, of course. You know, I think it is, I don't mean to sound too grandiose, but I think it is the task of the writer, or at least I take my own task as a writer, to give a sense of what it feels like to be alive at any particular period of history, but more particularly our own. And during the 4 or 5 years that I was working on this book, I felt that more and more we were all living in a kind of wonderland. And I'm not the only novelist or fiction writer who has been at times baffled by how one should get that sense of eeriness into a work of fiction that doesn't become implausible or silly. And so when I was working on this book, I was doing my best to make it both as grounded or realistic as I could on the one hand, and to some degree as fantastical on the other as I could, because that's the way these last few years have felt to me.
In the book, there's a sentence that basically boils down to, because I'm going to forget its specifics, that there are some kinds of nonsense that are less nonsensical than others. And I thought of the book that our very much admired and adored teacher, Irving Massey, wrote recently about nonsense. We're living in a time where people have very little patience for nonsense, but at the same time don't seem to recognize that it has the power to save us from the kinds of obstreperous unkindness that we have invented to replace nonsense. Were you thinking about Irving when you were writing this book, Irving Massey, a wonderful thinker and writer?
Well, I was, though I wasn't thinking of Irving Massey's ideas of nonsense specifically. You know, his thinking about nonsense has developed in such a way that he no longer can see nonsense divorced from metaphor and a metaphoric vision of the world. What I did borrow from Irving Massey was another idea he has had that you will remember, having to do with stories of change or metamorphosis. And one of his insights, and I have no idea how he came to this idea, but one of his insights is that when in literature there is an exchanged glance between a human being and an animal, something momentous or terrible is about to happen. And in this book, I found myself writing scenes. I don't know that they were directly influenced by Irving, but I found myself writing scenes in which my characters were exchanging glances with animals. In particular, there's a scene in which Christina goes to the zoo in St. Paul, Minnesota, in the middle of winter, and has a conversation with Y in front of the
wolf cage.
The wolf cage, and the wolves, in a uncanny way, come up to her and look at her as if she is about to be given a terrible task, which in fact she is. And so, yes, I mean, that in some ways that comes out of Irving Massey's thinking.
Charlie was a graduate student at Buffalo when I was an undergraduate. He's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met, and one of the most delicious and complexly beautiful writers I know. And this newest book, The Sun Collective, I think is an apotheosis of the things he knows and the things he fears. It's been a great, great pleasure, Charlie, to be able to have you on the show and to read The Sun Collective. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping from our respective residences, so you may hear unusual sounds. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. It can also be listened to on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. I want to say that if this is the first time you read a book by Charlie Baxter, I will be very proud to have made the introduction, because he's one of America's very best writers. Special thanks to Bookworm Show collaborators Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, and technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.